content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer. Today I'll be reading two articles from the February 4th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine. The first article is about the craze for hot chicken, an African-American dish from Nashville that has gone viral. And then the second article is about Boyan Slat's controversial plan to clean up the oceans. But first a poem, The Butterfly House by Frank Ormsby. One more butterfly in the butterfly house will count as overcrowding. Sun all morning and the heaviness of piped heat draws hundreds to the surface. They spend their days being exquisite in a history without wars. We are able, briefly, to forget the scaly intent, the cold-skinned slither 100 yards away in the tropical ravine. Hold up your arm, and with luck, you will emerge into the garden, badged and sleeved with butterflies, 1,000 bright sails opening around you. And now, from the Letter from Nashville section, an essay entitled The Spice Trade. An African-American chicken dish has gone viral. Who's getting the big money? By Paige Williams. 3 days after Christmas, in a part of northeast Nashville that many locals describe as dicey, a Ford Explorer crashed through the front of a discount tobacco shop at one end of a strip mall. Police later called the incident an attempted burglary. The vehicle, which had been reported stolen, was propelled by a brick waiting the accelerator. The store was empty. It was 4:30 in the morning. The authorities arrived to find the Ford abandoned and the shop on fire. 2 doors down, just past Jennifer Nails, Tyrese Lawless had come to work early, as usual, to clean the fryers at Prentice Hot Chicken Shack. After hearing a boom, he got out of there in case the flames reached the restaurant. Lawless began calling colleagues. To them and to generations of customers, Prince's is kind of a second home. Firefighters went inside and started yanking down ceiling tiles and cinch insulation. Ducts and wiring lay exposed, and there was extensive damage from smoke and water. As a precaution, the fire department shut off the strip mall's gas and electricity. Yellow police tape outside Prince's front door stretched toward the shattered glass of the targeted bodega. When Nashville residents learned that Prince's would be closed indefinitely, a minor panic ensued. In the past decade or so, the restaurant's signature dish, hot chicken, has proliferated worldwide, and the original incarnation, fried chicken, bathed in fiery spices, has been subjected to relentless permutation. Tacos, ramen, sushi, oysters, apple fritters, empanadas, pâté, poutine. The invention, now known everywhere as Nashville hot chicken, sounds like a viral novelty, like the cronut, but it long predates Instagram. It became popular more than 80 years ago in the city's black community, and the recipe originated with one family, the Princes. After the fire, @ThugBug tweeted, quote, "Literally any other hot chicken place could have burned down, but it had to be Prince's," end quote. Addressing the driver of the Ford Explorer, @OcipherJJ declared, "All of Nashville hates you, sir." In November, Eater named Prince's one of the 38 essential places to dine in America. 6 years ago, the James Beard Foundation gave the restaurant its America's Classics Award, which honors timeless establishments serving quality food that reflects the character of its community. Nashville Hot Chicken, the foundation said, was a totemic creation. The proprietors of Prince's and its many imitators regularly appear on TV, food, and travel shows. Anthony Bourdain, after sampling the hot chicken of a competitor, Bolton's, said, "I eat many strange and spicy things around the world, but never in my life have I experienced something like this." He added, "Is it food or an initiation ritual for Yankees?" Such comments can make eating Nashville hot chicken sound like one of those challenges in which people choke down spoonfuls of cinnamon. But for many diners, the dish is an obsession. In a short documentary for the Southern Foodways Alliance, a Prince's devotee describes hot chicken as worse than dope in its addictiveness. When Isaac Beard, who owned a massage therapy clinic in Nashville, first ate at Prince's hot chicken, he thought that it was just okay. Then about a month later, he woke up in the middle of the night with an enormous craving. "From that moment on, I was licked," he later told Timothy Charles Davis, the author of The Hot Chicken Cookbook, adding, "There's something legitimate there in hot chicken that's not there with, say, buffalo wings." Beard now owns a hot chicken restaurant, Pepperfire, 4 miles south of Prince's. On Fridays and Saturdays, Prince's stays open until 4 a.m., and in those early hours, graveyard shift workers share vintage wooden booth with country music artists and fans emerging from the honky-tonks. A Prince's employee once said that Beyonce and Jay-Z always send somebody down for takeout when they're in Nashville. Devotees from out of town are known to head to Prince's straight from the airport. In the Reddit thread Food Porn, someone once reported that a friend flew from Nashville with Prince's hot chicken in hand like she was carrying a donor organ. Ira Kaplan of the indie band Yolo Tinga heard about Prince's from Richard Baiute of the band Versus. Kaplan has recalled, "We were told it came in mild, medium, hot, and extra hot. But if we'd never been there before, we would not be allowed to have extra hot. We asked if we could at least taste extra hot sauce. What rubes we were! We were informed that there is no sauce." Kaplan found Prince's hot chicken simultaneously delicious and practically inedible. He ate it 4 days in a row. The band wrote a song about it, Flying Lesson, Hot Chicken Number 1, and then another, Don't Say a Word, Hot Chicken Number 2, and then another, Return to Hot Chicken. The weekend of the Ford Explorer crash, Prince's had been expected to be even busier than usual. The Tennessee Titans were at home playing the Indianapolis Colts, and the Predators, Nashville's popular hockey team, were also in town. One vehicle after another pulled into the empty parking lot and idled, the occupants confounded by the closed sign. The day after the crash, the woman who has been called the Queen Mother of Nashville Hot Chicken, Andre Prince Jeffries, drove to Prince's and parked in her usual spot, 4 feet from the front door. Jeffries, who is in her early 70s, has run the restaurant since 1980. She wears glamorous hairstyles, plum-colored lipstick, a smoky eye, and long lacquered nails. That day's shade was lavender. She also had on gray sweatpants, a matching shawl, UGG-style boots, and a red and purple crocheted cap. Enormous earrings dangled halfway to her chin. When she knows she'll be interviewed on camera, she may dress in a Prince's T-shirt. Otherwise, she does not advertise. She regularly declines offers to open franchises. She recently rejected a request from Dubai and to star in reality TV shows. Clutching a cane, Jeffries made her way into Prince's, where a few employees had started cleaning up. Spotting a brick near the front door, she shrieked, "Is that the brick that was on the accelerator?" Her event planner, Katrina Ware, laughed and said, "Nah, that brick's in evidence now." Jeffries said, "Have mercy." Her tinkly voice is laced with cackle and rasp. People eat at Prince's because of the chicken, but also because of the story behind it. Jeffries has spent the better part of her adulthood recounting the legend, for she inherited both the recipe, which is secret, and the family lore, which is unverifiable. In the 1930s, her great-uncle, Thornton Prince III, was a handsome pig farmer and fond of women. One Saturday night, he dragged home late and angering his girlfriend. The next day, Prince asked her to make his favorite food, fried chicken. The girlfriend complied, but with a furious twist, she saturated the bird in cayenne pepper and other spices. No doubt, Prince was expected to suffer, and he did, but he also enjoyed the experience. He began replicating the spicy fried chicken and selling it on weekends out of his home. He eventually opened a small restaurant, the Barbecue Chicken Shack, which became beloved in the black community. It became popular with white people, too, especially after the restaurant moved to a location near the Grand Ole Opry. Under Jim Crow, the princes were not free to dine wherever and however they wanted, or to use the front door of white establishments. But they never told their own customers where to sit or what door to use. The matter handled itself. Black patrons sat up front. Whites entered through the back door and sat in the back. Nashville, which was chartered in 1806 on the Cumberland River, is closer to Bowling Green, Kentucky, Union territory, than to Memphis. By the start of the Civil War, it was one of the country's 60 largest cities, with a population of 17,000. The Union Army saw Nashville as a potential supply center and captured the city in 1862. Escaped slaves flocked there, adding to an already sizable African-American population. The Prince family had been enslaved at a plantation south of town. Thornton Prince III seems to have been born around 1893. The civil rights leader, Ralph Abernathy, once said that in the black community of the 1930s, chicken was the best of all meals to serve, especially on Sundays. Gospel bird was better than ham, better than pork chops, better even than roast beef or steak. Timothy Charles Davis, in his cookbook, points out that poor people don't tend to document their lives the way well-off people do, and that American journalists of the early 20th century covered only high-end, white tablecloth places, not working man joints peopled by African Americans. The name of the girlfriend whose attempt at revenge inspired a culinary phenomena is unknown. The story is, quote, so perfect it almost seems created out of whole cloth, Davis noted. But he added, does this lobster roll story have such a story? I think not. The chef and TV personality Carla Hall, a Nashville native who made hot chicken the main attraction at her former restaurant in Brooklyn, has said that whatever the details about Thornton Prince's III's love life, the chicken ain't nothing but the truth. After Prince died around 1960, the restaurant got passed around to relatives, especially landing with Jeffries, the granddaughter of one of his brothers. She made some tweaks. First, she changed the name to Prince's Hot Chicken Shack. Hot chicken is not barbecue, she told me. She replaced the restaurant's 19-inch cast iron skillets with deep flat frying vats. Then, after a mother asked her why Prince's didn't serve chicken that wouldn't terrify her children, Jeffries introduced varying levels of spiciness. The current maximum level, triple X hot, is irresistible to spice hounds and fools. The menu board hanging above the order window features an image of flames. Prince's is so secretive about its recipe that employees must agree in writing not to divulge its details. Cameras aren't allowed in the kitchen, which is mostly walled off from customers' views. Devotees are left to guess at the ingredients: paprika, garlic, onion powder, vinegar, pickle juice, pork fat, bacon grease, sugar. Perhaps the chicken is marinated in spiced milk, dredged in spiced flour, fried in spiced cooking oil, and then coated in a spicy paste. Milk! Jeffries told me, no, 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 no. On Reddit, someone theorized that during the preparation of hot chicken, the oil combines with the chili to make some kind of undigestible lava. Simone Jeffries, Andre's daughter, who is in her early 50s and runs Prince's with her mom, can be seen in the background of one video ladling out a rich auburn liquid. But she has hinted the secret isn't just dousing some spicy stuff on top at the last minute. A customer once described Prince's hot chicken as spiced down to the bone. Decades ago, a former cook at Prince's left and started his own place, Columbo's, in downtown Nashville. In the 90s, Bill Purcell, who at that time worked as a lawyer, represented the restaurant in a tax matter. After trying its hot chicken, he ate at Columbo's at least once a week. When Columbo's closed amid downtown redevelopment, Purcell shifted his allegiance to Prince's, even though it was a 20-minute drive to northeast Nashville. In that part of town, 42% of the children live below the poverty line. Prince's zip code, 37207, has one of the country's highest incarceration rates. Recent neighborhood crimes have included assault, robbery, and break-ins. Jeffries often refers to my little thugs. She is talking about the reported drug dealers who watch over her and protect her business from harm. Purcell noticed that Prince's attracted an unusually broad cross-section of residents. The mixture of race, income, and ethnicity struck him as representative of the city he wanted Nashville to be. He told me, "This particular food is one that literally from the start has brought people together who would otherwise would not be in the same place." Hot chicken, he realized, might be Nashville's only indigenous food. In 1986, Purcell, a Democrat, was elected to the state legislature, and he eventually became the majority leader of the Tennessee House of Representatives. In 1996, in his last official act as a lawmaker, he declared Prince's to be the best restaurant in Tennessee and presented Jeffries with a printed proclamation. She hung it on the wall at Prince's, and after it grew yellow and grease-stained, she framed it. In 1999, Purcell was elected mayor. He served two terms until 2007. He ate at Prince's so often that people joked the restaurant had become his second office. During his final year as mayor, Nashville had its bicentennial, and Purcell commemorated it by creating the Music City Hot Chicken Festival. The event, held each 4th of July, begins with a parade of fire trucks. Nashville hot chicken can now be found everywhere from Los Angeles, Howling Rays, to Melbourne, Bell's Hot Chicken, to Singapore, Chick's Hot Chicken. In Chicago, the chef Jared Van Camp started Leghorn Chicken after developing a, quote, hot tooth, end quote. A dreadful form of hot chicken is now on the menu at KFC, and Pringles recently introduced a flavored potato chip that the Washington Post called an insult to the fine citizens of Nashville. Jeffries often jokes that Prince's success allows her to pay one more bill, but her modesty is considered part of her shrewd business sense. She lives in a one-bedroom place, but owns several properties in the Nashville area. Whenever Jeffries is asked what the Prince family thinks of copycats, she demurs. Thornton Prince, after all, was the first of the opportunists. The Nashville Tennessean recently tweeted, "What does the owner of Prince's think about all these hot chicken imitators?" One Prince's fan replied, "Miss Andre has always been so gracious about the Nashville hot chicken trend popularizing other restaurants, but Prince's is the OG, and that's that on that." On the Friday before the fire, Bill Purcell met me for an early lunch at Prince's. The restaurant opened at 11:30, and by 11:15, the line outside was a dozen deep. Jeffries wasn't expected until the late afternoon because she always works the shift that ends at 4 a.m. Bad fried chicken isn't worth the loss of the bird. On this, I am a reliable judge. Born and raised in Mississippi, I am the granddaughter of a fried chicken savant who always managed to keep the meat tender and the skin crispy. The chicken that I saw on the plates at Prince's looked like my grandmother's, only much darker, an almost umber shade. "It's such a personal chicken," Jeffries told me later. "Our hands touched every piece. It's not like in a machine. Our server was Tyrese Lawless, the man who was later cleaning the fryers when the Ford Explorer rammed into the tobacco shop. Purcell introduced Lawless, a former semi-pro football player, as a rising superstar of hot chicken. Lawless told me that when Simone hired him, he had warned, in her soft-spoken way, that she had warned in her soft-spoken way that if he discussed the marinade with anyone, he'd never work in the hot chicken world again. When he brought us our lunch, he described the secret ingredient as love. Prince's Hot Chicken is served on two slices of white bread. A short stack of dill pickle chips sits atop the chicken, speared with a toothpick. The bread and pickles may appear to be garnished, but they are, as the Beard Foundation put it, the closest thing to life rafts your taste buds will find. The bread, having absorbed the spices and oil, appears to be soaked in blood. The two chief attributes of hot chicken, fried chicken and spice, aren't an inevitable pairing. Southern food tends not to be spicy, except for tangy barbecue. A lot of deep southerners like jalapeno jelly with cream cheese on crackers, and we may add jalapenos to cornbread or to pintos or collards and speckle our turnip greens with a pepper sauce. But beyond Cajun territory, spice isn't a staple, making hot chicken an outlier in southern cuisine. Fans have noted the convergence of several pleasures at Prince's. The quality of the fry, the complexity of the seasoning, the degree of the burn. You either get it or you don't. I got it. The spices were deep and smoky, and as we ate, Purcell said what I was thinking. I wouldn't want the chicken to be hotter, and I wouldn't want it to be less hot. Nearby, a customer named Ashnay Goins and her daughter, Madison Steptoe, were waiting for their order. We invited them to sit with us until their number was called. Goins, who is 35, works for Verizon, and Madison is in the ninth grade. Both were wearing hijabs. When Purcell and I mentioned that we'd been talking about where Prince's customers come from, Goins said, "Well, we're from here. We're natives." Goins had eaten at Prince's all her life. An uncle who worked the third shift used to bring it home in an oily brown bag. "Prince's would be our Saturday night thing," she recalled. Madison had just been saying that one of her earliest memories was standing in line at Prince's with her mother. When the other hot chicken joints started opening, Goins tried them but declared everything but Prince's fake. At work, her colleagues called her the hot chicken connoisseur. For years, fans of Prince's clamored for a second location. Jeffries didn't want to do it. "If you franchise something like this, you miss all of that intimacy," she once said. In 2016, she gave in, and Prince's Hot Chicken Shack South opened in a former sports bar on the other side of town. Employees jokingly called the Northeast Nashville location the Shack, and South the Palace. The Shack seats 24 people. The Palace seats more than 100. It's got big screen TVs and beer on tap, and it closes well before 4 in the morning. On the walls, instead of the grease-stained proclamation and posters, there are enormous photographic portraits of Jeffries and Thornton Prince III. Aesthetically, it's not all that different from a Ruby Tuesdays. And on Reddit, someone wrote, "Boogie Prince's is much nicer in every conceivable way than OG Prince's, and somehow for that it's just less magical." The night after the fire, every seat was taken at the Palace with a line to get in. Whenever someone entered, an employee hollered, "It's a 45-minute wait for all orders!" I ordered a leg quarter, hot, to go, and sat at a table near the entrance to wait. Julie Tracy and Eric Hinton were sitting there, too. Tracy, an out-of-work hotel clerk in her late 50s, was lamenting the damage at the other Prince's and decrying its rivals as diabolical imposters. She has lived in Nashville for 31 years and had brought Hinton to Prince's for his first visit. He had moved to the city only recently from Illinois and kept a pen in his pocket in case he felt the urge to write a song. He decided to ease into hot chicken with medium, while Tracy adheres to the maxim, "Mild, baby, you told me. The medium about melted my face off, and I like spicy. She and Hinton also placed an double X hot order for Tracy's ex-boyfriend, whose diabetes had cost him a leg and an eye. Tracy told me that when she worked in hotels, she steered tourists to Prince's. It's important for people to hear how places like Prince's came about, she said. In the new Nashville, I see too many things gone. A few hours earlier, I'd been with Jeffries at the damaged location as she supervised the cleanup with Simone and several employees. I'm having the hardest time trying to adjust, she told me. I'm usually here until 4 in the morning, and after all these years, I can't believe I was off on a Friday. Looking around, she noticed that the vintage booths were missing. Wait a minute, she called out. Where are my benches? Well, they went into storage, Simone explained. She had also stashed away the kitchen equipment, the menu board, and the best restaurant proclamation. The shack had become such a landmark that she worried thieves might try to steal artifacts. Jeffries looked alarmed. We ain't going to be closed for that long. Simone explained that there were insurance matters to deal with, and the entire strip mall would need to be repaired and inspected before Prince's could reopen. And she told her mother gently, You're going to be closed for a few minutes. Jeffries absorbed the news. Life is full of transitions, she said. Like my mama always told me, no matter what happens, keep moving. And now from the A Reporter at Large section, The Widening Gyra, Boyan Slat's Controversial Plan to Clean Up the Oceans by Carolyn Corman. In May 2017, a 22-year-old Dutch entrepreneur named Boyan Slat unveiled a contraption that he believed would rid the ocean of plastic. In a former factory in Utrecht, a crowd of 1,200 people stood before a raised stage. The setting was futuristic and hip. A round screen set in the stage floor displayed 3D images of Earth. Behind Slat, another screen charted the rapid accumulation of plastic in the Pacific Ocean since the 1950s. Slat is pale and slight and has long brown hair that resembles Patti Smith's in the Horses era. He was dressed in a gray blazer, a black button-down, black slacks, and skateboarding sneakers, which he wears every day, although he doesn't skateboard. On stage, he presented plastic artifacts that he had collected from the Pacific during a research expedition. The back panel of a Game Boy from 1995, a hard hat from 1989, a bottle crate from 1977. This thing is 40 years old, he said in a Dutch inflected English. 1977 was the year that Elvis Presley left the building for good, presumably. The audience laughed. Slat then held up a clear plastic dish filled with shards of plastic. The contents of this dish are the actual stomach contents of a single sea turtle that was found dead in Uruguay last year, he said. A picture of the dead turtle flashed on a screen behind. Then Slat made his pitch. In the next 12 months, he and a staff of engineers at the Ocean Cleanup, an organization he founded in 2013, would build the system they had designed, assemble it in a yard on San Francisco Bay, and then set sail with it, traveling under the Golden Gate Bridge and out into the Pacific. Slat's destination was the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, midway between California and Hawaii, an area within what is known as the North Pacific Subtropical Convergence Zone. The patch is not, as is often believed, a solid island of trash, but a gyra, twice the size of Texas, where winds and currents draw diffuse floating debris into a vast carousel that never stops. There are four other ocean gyras in the world, but scientists believe that the one in the North Pacific contains the most trash, nearly 2 trillion pieces of plastic, weighing nearly 80,000 metric tons, according to a study that scientists working with the Ocean Cleanup published in the online journal Scientific Reports last March. The study found that 92% of the pieces are large fragments and objects, toothbrushes, bottles, umbrella handles, toy guns, jerry cans, laundry baskets, Most problematic, and accounting for half of the plastic mass in the gyra, are what sailors called ghost nets, great tangles of mile-long discarded fishing nets weighing as much as 2 tons, which can ensnare animals such as seals and sea turtles. Attempting to fish out this drifting morass of trash using conventional methods, vessels, more nets, would be a Sisyphean task. Slatt became famous for a TED Talk that he gave in 2012, in which he expounded on an idea that he had after a scuba diving trip in Greece during high school. Instead of trying to catch open ocean plastic, he thought, perhaps we could let the plastic come to us. The ocean currents moving around is not an obstacle, it's a solution, he told the audience. Slatt, 18 years old at the time, had entered an aerospace engineering program at the Delft University of Technology, and then, in keeping with the Silicon Valley archetype, dropped out before his second semester. But he had a big, vivid idea, a sweetly tremulous voice, and a goofy sense of humor. His Twitter bio reads, "Studied aerospace engineering, becomes a cleaner." The video went viral, and Slatt soon crowdfunded $2 million from donors in 160 countries. The United Nations Environment Program named him a 2014 Champion of the Earth, noting his keen mind and the lack of fear that marks out visionaries. The jury for the world's largest prize for design, the Danish INDEX award, granted him €100,000, stating that his, quote, incredibly ingenious idea will greatly improve the condition of the Earth's greatest natural resource, as well as the lives of millions, end quote. To date, Slatt has hired 80 employees and raised some $40 million from donors online, charitable foundations, the Dutch government, a few anonymous Europeans, and Silicon Valley billionaires like Peter Thiel and Mark Benioff. After many iterations and scale model tests of his invention, he and his team settled on a design. The mechanism that Slatt revealed in Utrecht was surprisingly simple. A 2,000-foot floating plastic boom attached to a geotextile skirt that would extend about 10 feet beneath the ocean's surface. The boom and the skirt would together create an artificial coastline that would accumulate flotsam, riding the gyre's currents, eventually forming a sort of shoreline of concentrated trash. On stage, Slatt gave a signal, and a black curtain behind him fell from the ceiling to reveal 4 monumental anchors. These were, Slatt said, key to the concept. They would hang hundreds of meters deep, where the currents are much slower than at the top, ensuring that the system moved more slowly than the trash, rather than just drifting around with it. At regular intervals, Slatt explained, a ship would transport the trash back to land where it would be recycled. Some of it would be turned into plastic products, sunglasses, photo cases, chairs, which the ocean cleanup could sell to generate revenue for more systems. He expressed the hope that by 2020 there would be 60 devices in the gyre. In 5 years, he said, they would have removed half of its trash. By 2040, Slatt promised he could clear 90% of the trash from the North Pacific gyre. The Monday after the announcement, Slatt arrived at the Ocean Cleanup's headquarters, an airy, modernist office in Delft. He was in high spirits. "We were at peak enthusiasm," he told me later. Online donations were rising, and his inbox was full of congratulatory notes. His first meeting of the day was with his top engineers. They did not look cheerful. The lead engineer said that they had been running some new tests and that they had not properly accounted for the power of, quote, a wave drift force, end quote, the accelerating energy of the surface waves absorbed by the device, which would cancel out the drag of the anchors. The design would not work. Slatt recalls the engineer saying, quote, "We're going to have to do it slightly differently." There were some possible solutions, the engineer said. How about loosening the anchors, allowing the device to race after the trash? Slack grew very quiet. It was a bit stressful, he said. Like, whoops. One of the pioneers of plastic pollution research and of conveying the findings in tangible images was Charles Moore, a horticulturalist and oceanographer who, in the 1990s, observed an alarming amount of garbage in the sea while sailing between California and Hawaii. Moore began taking researchers to the gyra, dragging nets alongside his catamaran and cataloging the contents. In 2001, Moore published the results of his studies. There was six times more plastic in the gyra by mass than there was zooplankton, the base of the food chain. Moore, charmingly grumpy, often with a map of the gyra and a dish of plastic shards in hand, went on to discuss the Great Pacific Garbage Patch on The Late Show with David Letterman, The Colbert Report, and Good Morning America. The image of the patch proved resonant, if misleading. Soon people were saying that you could walk on it and even spot it from outer space. In fact, most of what Charles Moore found was not large pieces of debris, but microplastic, the tiny fragments that remain when the sun breaks down, the larger hunks, and which the scientist and former U.S. Marine Marcus Erickson has called, quote, the smog of the sea, end quote. In 2008, Moore hosted Erickson and an ocean policy analyst named Anna Cummins on one of his expeditions. The two got married and later co-founded a nonprofit called the Five Gyrish Institute, which made research expeditions all over the world. In 2014, Erickson, Moore, and seven other co-authors published their findings in the online journal PLOS-1. More than 5.2 trillion particles of plastic were swirling in the planet's oceans, and in time, much of it would be ingested by the ocean dwellers and by creatures that eat fish, including people. Since then, numerous studies have shown that microplastic is everywhere, in the melting ice of the Arctic, in table salt, in beer, in shrimp scampi. A study last year found traces of it in 83% of tap water samples around the world. The incidence was highest in the United States at 94%. A major concern of scientists is that chemical toxins in the microplastics may leach off during digestion, gradually building up in animal and human tissues. Judith Enck, a senior official at the Environmental Protection Agency under President Obama, told me, "Where we are on plastics is where we were 15 years ago on climate change. We're just beginning to get the picture." According to Erickson and other environmentalists, the ocean cleanup is a, quote, distraction from the real solutions that the entire global movement is now working on, end quote. And yet it is undeniable that the plastic already in the ocean will not simply disappear without a trace. In this dire moment, people are desperate for heroes. Slatt agrees that prevention efforts are urgently necessary. For us to be successful, that part needs to be taken care of as well, he told me. But he added, all that large stuff will become the small, dangerous microplastic, and then we'll be in a much worse position. Given what Slatt sees as an inevitable torpor of political change, he believes it's his job to remove plastic from the gyres before it degrades into tiny particles, making the smog worse. The sooner we get it out, the better, he said. Unlike Moore and Erickson, Slatt has never sailed from California to Hawaii. I do enjoy being at the ocean, like most people, but not so much being on the ocean, he told me on a visit to New York after the Utrecht event. In 2015, he spent 8 days surveying plastic in the Bermuda Triangle, during which he was violently seasick. Slatt cares deeply about the environment, but for him, the appeal of cleaning the oceans is also about puzzle solving. There's no better feeling than having an idea and seeing it become reality, emerging in the physical world, he said. Still, he knows that people need a story if they're to get behind his idea. Don't get me wrong, he told me over tea in a downtown cafe with Juice Dubois, the 57-year-old head of communications for Ocean Cleanup. The trigger, the passion that made me want to do it, was its bigger significance, which you get from things like the experience I had scuba diving. on Slatt's scuba diving trip to Greece when he was 16, as he has said in countless talks and presentations, he saw more plastic bags than fish. At the mention of the well-worn anecdote, he shot Dubois a conspiratorial glance, and they laughed. Slatt had with him a black backpack decorated with sew-on patches from the Ocean Cleanup's plastic counting research expeditions, and he was wearing his usual skateboarding sneakers. If I didn't know him, I might have mistaken him for a high school student. Many of his supporters recall his youthful demeanor as well as his ageless poise as having won them over. Laurent Le Breton, the lead oceanographer for the Ocean Cleanup, describes him to me as a very smart boy. After the TED Talk and his subsequent decision to drop out of university, Slatt taught himself more about ocean plastic, oceanography, and engineering. He is the only member of his research team who does not have an advanced degree. But he keeps pace. One of the members of the Ocean Cleanup Scientific Advisory Board, Rick Spinrad, said, and until 2016, the chief scientist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recalled having been skeptical when he first met Slatt in 2016. I started asking more technical questions on windage and the relative velocity of plastic particles, on what physical oceanographic models he was considering using. His answers were sophisticated, savvy, and quite candid. When he did not have the tech answer, he certainly knew how to get that answer. It was obvious to me that he had been talking with the right folks. The list included scientists at Delft University of Technology and at the Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research. It was sunny and warm, and Slatt suggested that we take a walk. "When you walk, your brain is working better," he said. "More blood flow." We headed west to the Hudson River. Passing a small marina, we stopped, leaning over the railing to look at the dark, oily water. Dubois pointed at a drifting cigarette butt. Cigarette filters are made of cellulose acetate that leaches toxins into waterways. "Ocean plastic," he said. "Not ocean plastic yet," Slatt noted. "Will be soon," Dubois said. Just that morning, Nature Communications had published a paper by Slatt, the oceanographer Le Breton, and four other scientists, which estimated that as much as 2.4 million metric tons of plastic could be entering the ocean from rivers each year. Slatt is often asked whether he will develop a cleanup system for river mouths catching the plastic at its source. A few river mouth systems have already been successfully deployed, including three in Baltimore, known as Mr. Trash Wheel, Professor Trash Wheel, and Captain Trash Wheel. Universally celebrated by scientists and citizens, they are arguably the most beloved and sensible anti-plastic pollution mechanisms in the country. Slatt has a few ideas for river projects down the road, but he said, "If you do everything at the same time, you'll succeed at nothing." We walked around the southern tip of Manhattan, then cut back inland to a park in Chinatown, the spot Slatt had chosen for his next meeting. A tall man wearing a tuxedo and a woman in an evening gown appeared from between two parked cars and crossed the street toward us. The man was Hugh Welsh, the head of DSM North America, an arm of a Dutch multinational company that manufactures products including resins and plastics for the building and automobile industries, electronics, medical equipment, and food packaging. Dubois greeted Welsh warmly. He used to work as public relations director for DSM, and Welsh has become a major donor to the ocean cleanup. Welsh and his colleague apologized for their attire. They were on their way to a black tie event. In recent years, environmental groups such as Upstream and the international movement hashtag Break Free from Plastic, which Froleon Great helps lead, have argued for what's become known as extended producer responsibility, the idea that the manufacturers of products that become waste must bear the burden of cleaning it up, especially when they send those products to developing countries that have little solid waste disposal or recycling infrastructure. Slat's model, which relies on voluntary donations, might seem a good place to start, or conversely, a compromise that will make plastic producers feel better about doing little to address the problem at its source. An entire fleet of 60 of Slat's systems could cost around $360 million, and Slat hopes that much of this will come from corporations that have a stake in the production of plastic. Slat politely greeted Welsh, who seemed amused and intrigued by the young Dutchman, as if he were meeting a child celebrity. "Is this your first time to New York?" he asked Slat, who had been to the city many times before. Slat said, "No, but it's even more interesting every time." Dubois and Welsh walked ahead, and Slat bid me farewell. It would be a private meeting. Slat later told me that he had hoped companies like DSM or anyone who wanted to help the ocean would start sponsoring systems. They would have plenty of space for logos if there is any company out there that wants to be smart, he said. I met Slat again 10 months later in April at the Bleak Waterfront Assembly Yard in Alameda, across the bay from downtown San Francisco. A tower housing Mark Benioff's company, Salesforce, stood high on the skyline. Across from a row of ancient school buses awaiting retrofits, a turquoise ocean cleanup sign announced the presence of the prototype, home of System 001. Resting on head-high risers was an enormous black plastic pipe, the first segment of the 2,000-foot device's boom. Workers were about to start the next fusion weld. Slat's original idea, using the ocean's currents to do the work of collecting trash, has remained the foundation of his design, but almost everything else has changed. His first blueprint, presented at the TED Talks in 2012, owed more to science fiction than to reality. A chain of manta ray-shaped stations that would passively funnel trash into their bellies. In this model, an underwater system of mooring lines would anchor the entire structure to the seabed, 15,000 feet below. In the summer of 2016, Slat launched a prototype called Boomy McBoomface, a suggestion from social media followers, into the North Sea. Within 2 months, the ocean had torn it apart. Although Slat's engineers were increasingly convinced that mooring a structure to the seabed would not work, Slat was reluctant to let go of the idea. "As an inventor, your inventions are your babies," he said. Besides, he added, "it can be very risky if you leave an old idea and switch to a new idea too soon. It's like a new girlfriend. You don't see the flaws." At a banner at the assembly yard showed, the final blueprint had no anchors. Instead, it consisted of a free-floating boom bent into the shape of a horseshoe with a skirt secured to its underside. The new idea was that the device, driven by the forces of the wind and waves from outside the horseshoe, would act like a sweeper, reorienting itself when the wind changed direction. Models and tests suggested that the sweeper would travel about 15 centimeters per second faster than the plastic and collect 2.2 metric tons of trash a week. GPS trackers, cameras, and sensors positioned every 100 meters along the length of the boom would communicate the system's progress to the team on shore, as well as indicate its presence to passing marine vessels and monitor for wildlife. Early on the morning of September 8th, the day of the launch, Slat dreamed that the pipe had been sent out into the seawater and had begun to melt. He woke up and could not get back to sleep, so he started preparing for the dozens of interviews he would give that day. The sky was blue with light winds and warm air. When he arrived at the pier in San Francisco Bay, the top deck of the media boat, a ferry, was already packed with cameramen and reporters. The Ocean Cleanup's publicity crew, seven strong, wore turquoise Ocean Cleanup shirts, which matched the turquoise-painted Maersk tug ship that would tow the system out to the gyra. Maersk, the largest shipping line in the world, was providing the ship and its crew free of charge. A mayor's spokesman named Stephanie Gillespie was aboard, and she told me, "Our seafarers sail through this garbage patch and see this plastic everywhere, so it made sense for our company to invest in cleaning it up." The team had given Slat's invention a name, Wilson, for the volleyball that Tom Hanks lost at sea and befriends in Castaway. Slat held a brief press conference concluding, "For 60 years, mankind has been putting plastic into the oceans. From this day onward, we're taking it back out again." The ferry set off, and a few minutes later, Wilson came into view, gliding behind the Maersk ship like a long black tail. It was already speckled with bird droppings. At the moment when the media ferry was behind the ship, as it approached the Golden Gate Bridge, Slat jumped up to stand on some benches at the bow for pictures, his hair blowing in the wind. Then a deckhand emerged from the bridge and yelled, "Please get down!" Slat, looking embarrassed, stepped off the bench. The journey back was fast, and once ashore, Slat collapsed on a flower planter along the boardwalk. "I'm dead," he said. Dubois and a few other ocean cleanup staff were staring at their phones. Dubois started cheering. "We just got to 100,000 Instagram followers." 5 weeks after the launch, on October 16th, Wilson, towed behind the Maersk, arrived at the North Pacific Gyra, a few dozen degrees of longitude east of the international dateline. An ocean cleanup engineer had given Wilson its own Twitter feed, and its coordinates and pictures of its surroundings were posted almost daily. Each picture showed a portion of the pipe, and when the sun was shining, sparkling blue water. There was no plastic in sight. A week later, Slat tweeted a picture. First plastic, two bobbing white baskets, and a scattering of fragments were visible in the waves. As the weeks passed, Wilson behaved as the engineers hoped it would, reorienting itself when the wind changed direction, catching and concentrating plastic in its arms. But then, much of the plastic would float away, back out to the infinite, or drift around Wilson and collect along its back. Slat's engineers developed 27 hypotheses to explain why this happened. Wilson was moving too slowly, sometimes slower than the plastic. Perhaps a surface plastic was more affected by the wave drift force than they had calculated. Or perhaps an inertial current, one much smaller and more localized than the main one they had accounted for, was slowing Wilson's motion. This is, of course, something we never saw in the computer models, which underlies why it's so important that we are out there, Slat said. And when I met him in New York again, just before Christmas. "Another fun one is the jellyfish hypothesis," he said. Scientists noticed that Wilson's arms were oscillating, creating a propulsion that resembles the way a jellyfish swims, and causing Wilson to swim away from the plastic. Slat had a cold and hadn't slept much for several weeks. Headlines had blared the system's failure, and critics on Twitter scoffed at Slat's boondoggle. "What I would be afraid of is that if it fails, we let down the world," he said. "People will point at it and say, 'Look, fancy gizmo, silver bullet, panacea. Basically, that proved that that is not the way to solve a problem.'" But his team of engineers had helped him come to peace, he said, as they all returned to work. He was already considering new iterations, possibly incorporating sails or wave gliders that would make Wilson go faster. When I described Wilson's plight to Chris Garrett, a physical oceanographer and an emeritus professor at the University of Victoria, he told me that he had found the entire premise of the device rather strange and puzzling. He described the ocean cleanup system as medium-level technology with a high risk and a high payoff. "The sea is an unrelenting trial judge," he said. "The probability of failure was at least as high as the probability of success." He added, "I see nothing that cannot be remediated with good physics and engineering and money." The team has since stated that Wilson collected 2 metric tons of plastic. A week and a half after Slat and I met in New York, crew members stationed in the Gyra were doing a maintenance check of Wilson when they noticed that one end of the boom, an 18-meter section, had snapped off and floated away, owing apparently to material fatigue on a small section. Perversely, Williams plastic wasn't durable enough. The section was retrieved and the two parts were towed to Hawaii, arriving just off the coast on January 17th. The last time I spoke to Slat on January 7th, he was undeterred. "This is just a first act," he said. "It's not a system failure, it's a component failure." His words reminded me of an episode soon after Wilson's launch in Pacifica, a beach town south of San Francisco. Slat had learned that I surfed, and despite being a beginner, he suggested that we go together. On the beach, he told me about a small rip in Wilson's skirt that occurred during the trip to the Gyra. The skirt was Wilson's most expensive component. It needed to be made by hand and required 48 people working for 60 days in a warehouse in the United Arab Emirates to assemble. That material seemed impenetrable, so it was a little hard to believe, Slat said. The wind was blowing onshore, turning the waves into a mess of white foam, and it was a long, exhausting paddle beyond the impact zone to calm water. Once there, Slat and I watched other surfers for a while, and then Slat spotted a small ridge. He turned, paddled away, and disappeared. His board bobbed up to the surface without him, and then he got tossed far back toward the shore by the waves that followed. Some 20 minutes later, after another fight through breaking waves, he reappeared beside me. "Now I feel how Wilson feels," he said, gasping. "I feel sorry for him. So much power under there." And he sat on his board. Striving to catch his breath, he returned to Wilson's journey to the Gyra. "The skirt weighs 27,000 kilograms," he said, "but when the swells are big enough, it can flip out of the water like a flag in a hurricane." As the afternoon passed, Slat stayed in the water, growing bolder, trying and failing to get up on his feet and right a wave, washing to shore instead, and then fighting the endless white water to get back out. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, triangleradingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.